Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast.
Good Monday afternoon. It's the show on 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Steve Goldstein. We should stay mostly sunny through the rest of this afternoon, could reach a high temperature right around 104. And then coming up for tonight, clear skies, lows around 80. For tomorrow, very similar to today, sunny skies with a high of 103. Currently, relative humidity is at 14%, and it's 100 degrees at KJZZ. One accident to tell you about on the Valley Freeways. It's on the 101 westbound at Scottsdale Road. 70% of the copper mined in the U.S. comes from Arizona, used as electrical wiring and metal piping for home builders nationwide and exports worldwide. But as KJZZ's Heather Van Blockland reports, one of Arizona's seminal industries faces a threat as copper production slows and pricing falls. An Arizona State University economist explains the lackluster recovery in the U.S. housing market is one reason.
The U.S. market for housing is a big deal, and it can help drive the price of commodities.
That's economics professor Dennis Hoffman of the W.P. Carey School of Business, who says commodities like copper need a strong housing market, where new homes are being built at a regular pace, and there's a need for pipes and wiring made from copper.
Housing is in a recovery, but the frenzy around building is nowhere near like it was in 04, 05, and 06. The pace at which we construct homes affects the price of copper.
So the price of copper has gone down, and while the current price in the $2 per pound range is nowhere near an all-time low for one of Arizona's signature industries, it's a 50% drop from the $3 to $4 per pound price during the housing boom. Heather Van Blockland, KJZZ News.
Tomorrow is the primary election, and it'll be a different setup than the last two elections we had in May and March. It's also the first election since a new law took effect to prevent so-called ballot harvesting. Joining us now is KJZZ's Jude Joffe Block to tell us what we can expect on Tuesday. So, Jude, what do voters who are planning to actually vote in person tomorrow need to know?
So there was a lot of confusion last March with the presidential preference election about independents and whether they could vote or not. So in this primary, they can vote. Independents can go. They can choose which party's ballot that they want, and they're fine. Also, the other big change since both March and May is that this time voters have to vote in their assigned polling place. So this will be their neighborhood place that most likely they're used to going to, though there are some new places, so it might have changed. And it's very important because that's really the way that your vote will be counted, is if you go to the right place.
Well, so what happens if people go to the wrong place?
So this year, this is the first presidential year that Maricopa County poll workers have e-books. And the e-books are sort of like these tablets. And when voters check in, the poll worker should be able to immediately know if that voter is in the wrong place. And most importantly, should be able to know where to send them. And I got to see this at a training. The machine actually prints out a little receipt with the address of the right polling location for that voter. And so hopefully we'll send them on their way. If the voter will be offered the opportunity to fill out a provisional ballot, but in this case, that provisional ballot will be disqualified because the voter was in the wrong place. So not really that helpful of an option.
And this is the first election where a new law is in place that makes it a felony to turn in other people's vote by mail ballots unless you're a family member or a caregiver. How could that impact this election?
So this bill was being pushed by Republicans in the state legislature who thought that there was a need to protect the integrity of the election by prohibiting other people from handling their early ballots. Democrats argued this was a partisan effort meant to disenfranchise, lower the Democratic turnout and vote. The Maricopa County Recorder's Office has said they don't plan on doing anything different this election because they don't have any instructions of how to enforce this new law. Meanwhile, I should say that the law is actually being challenged in federal court, but it is in effect right now, and this is our first election with it. On Saturday, the Arizona Republican Party had a training to train poll observers. These are partisan poll observers who will be inside the polling places, and gave them instructions about this particular law taking effect. I spoke to one of those observers, Nina Marlowe. Here she is.
What set me to it was our county recorder saying that she wasn't going to uphold the law in terms of ballot harvesting. And I'm concerned about that because I've had people come to my door asking for my ballot.
And the training was done by lawyers for the Republican Party, but it was closed to the public.
What are Democrats and voting rights advocates who opposed the law in the first place doing in preparation for Tuesday?
So I spoke with Samantha Pistras from the Arizona Advocacy Network. She's concerned that Republican poll observers are going to be focused on the ballot harvesting issue because she says it's a murky thing to look out for and could wind up resulting in voter intimidation. Here she is.
What do you look for? How do you know if someone claims to be the family member, how do you verify that? There's no guidelines. I don't know how that's going to play out. I don't think people will be collecting ballots. I know we've really been putting the message out there to please don't do that. It is a felony. Even if we don't agree with it, we need to follow the law.
She said she hopes no one inadvertently violates the new law. Her organization has held a training on Saturday for volunteers who will be looking out for voter intimidation or other issues at certain polling places.
And can these volunteers be inside the polling place?
So some will be inside, others will be outside. There's a 75-foot barrier, but there is this special role for poll observers who are certified by a political party to be inside, but only if you're affiliated with a party. But this raises kind of an interesting question. To be inside the polls and observe, you have to be affiliated with a party in a state with so many independent voters. You know, what about them? So it raises some questions.
KJZZ's Jude Jaffe Block getting us ready for tomorrow's primary. Jude, thanks.
Thank you.
Arizona has consistently cut taxes in recent years, and Governor Doug Ducey has said it's his goal to continue reducing taxes every year he's in office. He's even floated the idea of eliminating the personal income tax altogether. But whether tax cuts actually do much to improve the state's business climate has been a matter of disagreement. A new report by the nonpartisan Grand Canyon Institute concludes that education investment has a much more positive impact on economic performance than reducing taxes. Dave Wells is research director for the Grand Canyon Institute. And Dave, how did you compile the numbers to draw your conclusions?
Well, we wanted to measure economic performance, which is a little different than economic growth. Economic growth includes both population increases and people's well-being increasing. And we wanted to really focus in on well-being increase. Places like Arizona, we've had our population increasing faster than the nation. When I went back as far as 1969. So there are four measures that we used. One is essentially a productivity measure, which is the change in state gross domestic product per job. And then we're also looking at an income measure, which is the growth in per capita personal income over the same periods of time. And then we looked at the unemployment rate over the last year using the average of two. The one is a conventional one, which is called U3. And then there's a broader one, which includes people who have become discouraged, are sort of more marginally attached to the labor force. They would maybe be able to work if they could get childcare. And that's called U6. So we average those two. So we have more of the conventional one, but also giving some sense of the broader labor market underutilization. And finally, neither GDP or per capita income includes the distribution of it. And as you may have heard from the Bernie Sanders campaign, the top 1% have been doing pretty well. So there's a thing called a Gini coefficient. The Gini coefficient measures income inequality. And so from the period of 2009 to 2014, we looked at the growth of personal income and how equal or unequal that was. So those are the four measures that we used for economic performance, and we ranked the states. We ranked them for each of those measures and then averaged the ranks and ranked them again.
And Arizona ranked?
50th, unfortunately. That was not intended. I had done a similar study in 2010, and we ranked 34th then. Arizona has underperformed, especially in this last expansion.
But certainly since Governor Ducey took office, a former businessman, this was seen as Arizona's business climate is really growing. But based on whatever business climate is seen as compared to having the well-educated workforce, it doesn't seem like those should be sort of on opposite ends of the spectrum here. Are there things that could push those together? Like, is Proposition 123 something that could put the state in that direction?
Yes. The question is what kind of jobs you have. And I think a lot of what we found with the business indices is they did not correlate with, especially if they were narrowly focused mostly on just taxes, and then they had no correlation at all with economic performance. They may correlate with aggregate growth, which includes the population changes across the states, but not with quality. But the education measures did. And I think that it's because then you're getting at a higher quality workforce, and that's going to lead to higher paying jobs. And it wasn't close. So we found things like looking at the average high school graduation rate over a period of 2003 to 2009. These are people who are now 24 to 30. We're looking at things like the National Assessment for Educational Progress. And again, for this one, we tried to even out the free and reduced lunch. So we tried to make the states economically as equivalent as we could.
I've heard from certain observers that NAEP, that Arizona is actually doing better in NAEP, at least in the last year or two. Mm-hmm. And also, as much commitment as there seems to have been in Arizona to reduce high school dropout rate, it actually, based on the numbers you had from 2010 to 2014, high school graduation has actually gone down?
Yeah, we're worse. So on the NAEP part of it, I found comparing the two, and NAEP is done every other year. So 2005 to 2009 compared to 2013 to 2015, we were the fifth best state in terms of improvement. And that was trying to be economically equivalent. But on high school graduation, they've come up with a better measure, which actually tracks individual students. And that's only been available since the 2011 class. And from 2011 to 2014, Arizona is the worst state. Only a few states have had a decline in their graduation rate. But now we're actually tracking individual students. Before, it was sort of a broader measure. They look at the freshman class and what the class was 4 years later, and they do a division, and that's your high school graduation rate. We're the worst state in terms of lack of improvement and the worst decline. So that's not a good indicator.
Dave Wells is research director for the Grand Canyon Institute. His new report focuses on the impact of educational achievement and tax cuts on economic performance. Longtime Arizona lawmaker Carolyn Allen died over the weekend at the age of 78. She'd been in hospice care. Allen served in the legislature for 16 years, retiring from the state Senate in 2010. Allen represented Scottsdale and was well known for being extremely straightforward with her views. Luigi Del Puerto of the Arizona Capital Times covered some of Allen's time in the legislature and joins me now. Luigi, she was a dedicated lawmaker and at the same time one who could be very direct.
And if she was hurling criticisms, then you duck. At the same time, she was lovable. I mean, people adored her. She worked on several big issues when she was in the legislature. Among them was welfare reform. She was known for her advocacy for the arts community. And she really fought year in and year out to make sure that the arts community had its budget. And that became very crucial beginning 2008 when the economic crisis hit. Lawmakers were looking at all places to cut, but she made sure that the arts community and the budget for the arts community was preserved. She understood the relevance of funding for the arts.
And SB 1070, what did she have to say about that?
Right, and SB 1070, of course, who could forget that? She was the only Republican in the Senate who voted against 1070. And she was especially proud of that vote. In fact, Bert Coleman, her longtime consultant, told me that that was the vote that she was most proud of, and that she was still talking about it. Like just 6 months ago, she was still talking about that vote. In a way, she sort of epitomized the description, the label Rhino, Republican in name only. But she always contended, she always argued that it wasn't her that moved, but it was her party that drifted rightward, and that when her party drifted rightward, she found herself in a situation that she couldn't toe the party line on major issues.
How unique is Carolyn Allen? Yes, there are people who are so-called moderate Republicans who may buck party leadership. We certainly saw that at times with Senate President Andy Biggs, where that happened, where there was a coalition of members who decided to do this. But Carolyn Allen didn't just do that sort of thing. She was very outspoken about doing it. Do we expect to see someone like her anytime soon?
No, I don't. And she really is unique. Often you'll see people pick their battles. They'll fight here and give in here. Carolyn Allen didn't pick her battles. She would fight, and she had her set of principles. And she made no bones about letting people know what they are.
Luigi Del Puerto of the Arizona Capital Times. We've been talking about former lawmaker Carolyn Allen, who passed away over the weekend. And Luigi, thank you.
Thank you.
The McDowell Sonoran Preserve has been one of Scottsdale's more popular public projects over the past couple of decades. The preserve attracts thousands of walkers, joggers, and hikers over its more than 30,000 contiguous acres, which host 170 miles of trails. But there's passionate disagreement over whether the preserve should soon include the Desert Discovery Center, which its website describes as, quote, an interpretive center for residents and visitors and an important attraction for Scottsdale's tourism industry. In a few minutes, we'll hear from a Desert Discovery Center opponent. We start with Melinda Gulick, an advocate of the center. She's also a former member of the Desert Discovery Center Scottsdale Board. Melinda, tourism is a driving force in Scottsdale. How would the center fit into that part of the city's mission?
Well, Steve, Scottsdale is a community that's known for its big ideas, and clearly we have an international brand that is the Sonoran Desert. But when tourists come to Scottsdale, they don't necessarily have a way to easily experience the desert. And when you talk to tourists or you talk to the hoteliers, they experience the desert from the spa, the golf course, or the pool. So this is Scottsdale's chance to really pay off that brand and allow people to experience the Sonoran Desert. But the Desert Discovery Center isn't just for tourists. It's for residents, too. Mm-hmm. It's for children. It's for school kids. It's for adults. It's for the disabled so they can access the preserve. And the elderly who might not be hikers anymore.
How does this fit into what the overall vision of the preserve has been?
The preserve is and was an impossible dream. You know, a community came together to set aside ultimately 30,000 acres of open space, and they taxed themselves to do it. It's amazing. I think there's over 200 miles of trails, and it's the largest urban preserve in, I think, Northern America, if not the Northern Hemisphere. Today, 500,000 people experience the preserve, and it's amazing. But they experience for recreation purposes or fitness purposes. The Desert Discovery Center gives us a chance to educate people about it, about the Sonoran Desert, the many layers of the Sonoran Desert. The Desert Discovery Center actually predates the preserve. It was an original vision of a woman by the name of Florence Nelson. And it was her vision to create an interpretive center about the Sonoran Desert in North Scottsdale. As the preserve came to be, the site for the Desert Discovery Center moved to the gateway, partly because the site is moved away from the mountains and you can experience the full majesty of the McDowells from the gateway, and also because of the accessibility to the 101, to Westworld, and that sort of synergy between all of the things happening in the Bell Road Corridor.
In an ideal world, what would the Desert Discovery Center look like?
So the vision for the Desert Discovery Center is that it's a world-class place for education and research about the desert. In an ideal world, it would do both of those things, and it would be financially sustainable. The reason for things like a gift shop or a cafe is to create opportunities for earned revenue so that the facility can support itself. All of those plans, though, and Steve, it's important that we sort of take a wait-and-see approach, are under development right now, and we won't have an idea what the facility looks like or all of the components will be until the fall of 2017. So I know there's lots of talk about the Desert Discovery Center in the community, and what I would urge people to do is understand that the people who support the Desert Discovery Center have been involved in the preserve effort since the beginning. We are one and the same with the preserve, and we're taking a methodical, appropriate, conscientious approach to creating a place that celebrates the desert and is appropriate to the preserve.
Melinda Gulick is a supporter of Scottsdale's proposed Desert Discovery Center. Jason Alexander is part of NoDDC, an organization opposing the center. Jason, you say you think the McDowell Sonoran Preserve is one of Scottsdale's highlights, but you oppose the center. If the center were limited in its size and scope, could you support it?
Well, you know, that question comes up with our group a lot, and we always say we are not a no group. If you talk to the people who follow us, and we have probably 1,500 followers, we get about 10,000 engagements a week between our Facebook page and our blog. Almost universally, they all believe in the idea of sharing the story of the preserve and of education. What we do not support is how that this project has been driven forward by a group of special interests, largely out of the public eye, and that it has grown from the original conception in 2008, which was largely implemented already at the Gateway Trailhead, into a 75 million, 30-acre, 70,000 square feet, 15-building project, which the public has no vote over.
Are you most concerned about money that you feel like the city shouldn't be spending on that? Are you concerned that it goes against the mission of what the preserve should be?
There's absolutely concerns on both those points. $75 million, if you just take what the current project is, translates to $300 for every resident of Scottsdale. That's $1,200 for my family. I absolutely don't believe that the city government should be taking on that project without a public vote. And then within the context of the preserve, the reason it is being pushed so hard to be within the preserve is because they're going to build it with the preserve fund surplus. There is a projected $160 million surplus in the preserve fund by the time the preserve tax expires. What are they going to do with that money? Jim Lane has come right out and said on July 12th at the McDowell Mountain Ranch community meeting, I'm not interested in it not being on the preserve. It's very obvious. We've had an accountant analyze the city budget, that they're storing all that money up and that they plan to use it to build the Desert Discovery Center. That's our tax dollars that we voted to set aside for preservation, not for a museum.
What do you think is worthwhile, and even in a limited scope, what do you think you could support?
I think we would support something that first and foremost has more voter input and participation in it. There are currently great educational offerings at the Gateway Trailhead. There is the Bajada Nature Trail, which is handicapped accessible. It comes complete with educational signage and documentation. With the $2.2 million they spent just this year on the architect and the experience designer, we could build an app that is geolocated and could tell you about things as you walk through a trail. There could be a very small museum center like they built at Brown's Ranch. I think that came together for about $3-4 million. So there is certainly room for compromise. What the people do not want is a tourist destination, and that's what the city is marketing. That's what's in the contract right now, that the global it will be a global tourist destination, and that's what people are objecting to.
Scottsdale is associated with tourism. So what concerns you about this particular thing? Because again, Scottsdale, a lot of its marketing is tourism, tourism, tourism.
The myth that this will be good for tourism has been completely unsubstantiated. And in fact, in 2013, there was a very well-studied report, the Places Consulting Report, paid for by folks in the tourism industry, that came right out and listed concerns about this, that it would not be competitive with the Botanical Garden, with the Phoenix Zoo, that it would not get the traffic they're estimating, that it would only be busy during certain months of the year, and that there would be constant pressure on it to keep changing its exhibits. And in so doing, it would just have massive cost overruns every year.
Jason Alexander is a part of the No DDC effort, which is opposing the proposed Desert Discovery Center in Scottsdale. It's Monday, so let's celebrate the working life. We're talking to the people who do the jobs you sometimes don't see or don't think about. There are about 500 vinyl billboards and 60 digital ones around the valley, lifting, stretching, fastening, and that's just what the crew goes through. Today we step into a day on the job installing a new billboard.
My name's Paul Sweeten, bill poster. Just get up on the billboards and change out the advertisements for Clear Channel Outdoor. We're at McDowell and 92nd Street. So sometimes we could get 10 done in a day, which should take us about 10 hours. But if we work really hard, we get done in 8 hours. We have our big vinyls that will roll out and get prepared for the board, and it's kind of what I like to describe as stretching a canvas over a frame. We stretch it over the face of the board and tighten it down, get all the wrinkles out, and we're good to go. Put up the ladder, tie it off so it doesn't fall off, and then we strap on our harnesses there, and then get on the board and start working on it. The wind picks up too much for me. These we're taking down, it's a little bit easier, but putting stuff up, it's a little bit more dangerous having the wind. When we hooked the extension up to the crane, big gust of wind came. I called it quits because when it's spinning like that, I don't want any of my guys near it. Even a broken finger in this job puts you out of commission, you can't work. We're just going to secure it down for now. Hopefully the wind will die down in an hour or so, so we can come back and finish. And we don't change the big extensions very often, so to have it this windy on the one day we change it, it's kind of unfortunate.
That's Paul Sweeten installing a billboard in the East Valley.
The bodies of nearly 900 people remain unidentified in Pima County, the result of years of illegal border crossings that funneled people through the Arizona desert. Now a new program is underway to use DNA to match those remains to thousands of people who've been reported missing. From KJZZ's Fronteras desk in Tucson, Michel Marisco reports.
On August 8th of this year, a Border Patrol agent tracking a group of people who had crossed illegally in from Mexico came upon the lonely remains of what was likely a person who had crossed the border into the U.S. The remains were scattered, incomplete, and the person that once comprised, unidentified, unknown. It's an old story in this quiet desert, this slow, lonesome way to die. Smugglers are paid to guide people through trails that slither through green mesquite and Palo Verde, but too often leave their clients behind in the rush to keep moving and avoid detection. Some migrants choose to bypass the enterprising criminal networks that roam this desert and go it alone, and are quickly overwhelmed by the magnitude of a long walk through a hard country. This desert holds bones, and it guards their identity like secrets. Inside the Pima County Medical Examiner's building in Tucson, researchers are trying to change that. Dr. Greg Hess.
So we're here in the cooler. You can see that the remains to the right-hand side of the cooler in these white body bags are generally our undocumented border crosser remains. As an example of what we have, we can look over here where we have these a number of smaller body bags on this particular tray. The one that I'm currently looking at is labeled 15-3103, which means it's these remains were recovered in 2015.
The bag holds a lower jawbone and several smaller bones. Case 153103's brittle yellow specimens will be interred, but now forensic anthropologists have a digital ID card, the DNA of the person this lower jawbone belonged to. Last year, Hess's staff performed autopsies on 138 people found in the desert. It's been this way since 2001 in Arizona, when the state became the predominant region for illegal border crossings. Since then, 2,600 people have been found dead. And of that, nobody knows who nearly 900 of these people were. All presumably migrants, and all found within roughly 100 miles of the border. Camerina Santa Cruz lives in a tidy home in a Tucson neighborhood. She became a Jehovah's Witness, and on this day that I visited her, she was rehearsing a song from her studies class that she attends at night. It's been 3 years since her son disappeared. On August 17, 2013, Marco Antonio Ramirez left Nogales, Sonora with two friends. 3 days later, those friends told his mother he didn't make it.
Yo sí tengo esperanza que mi hijo esté vivo. La esperanza es lo que
she has faith he's still alive. She calls it a mother's faith. Santa Cruz was part of the nonprofit Colibri Center's Test DNA Match program last year. Colibri Center's Kat Rodriguez.
It's just waiting on the results, so she might have answers. Her son may very well, her son's been missing almost exactly 3 years. He very much could be one of those 900.
The nonprofit has fielded 2,500 calls from people now living in the U.S. who called in to report missing family members. Rodriguez dials a woman from Phoenix whose brother went missing in June 2014. The Colibri Center's DNA program may end up matching one of these 900 bodies with the woman's brother.
This project is a way to know if it's him. It's also a way to give families the answer that he's not here. And sometimes knowing that is also really important. I mean, that's what
the DNA samplings will happen throughout the U.S., the first one this fall in San Francisco. So for now, Santa Cruz and thousands more family members like her wait. First for a DNA swab, then for the results of those tests to see if those lonely remains, like that lower jawbone of case 153103, belonged to their loved ones. Michel Marisco, KJZZ News. Tucson.
It's the show on 91.5, along with John Hockenberry at The Takeaway. I'm Steve Goldstein. It's been a few bad weeks for Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump, and those moments seem to be crystallizing the view that his candidacy may have permanent consequences for the House and Senate. There are a handful of incumbents in the Senate that are feeling what's being called the Trump burden,
And if enough of them lose their seats this fall, it could spell an end to the Republican majority in the House or Senate or both. The Takeaway's Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick is here. And Todd, what do you think of that?
Senate, probably. I mean, the Democrats could make some significant gains due to the Trump down ballot effect, which appears to be hurting Republicans. I'm still of the mind, and I'm not alone in this, that the chances of Nancy Pelosi being Speaker next January are still pretty low. Republicans have a massive majority in the House. It takes more than one election to undo it, unless it's a utter complete meltdown. However, the Senate was trouble for Republicans, John, before Donald Trump ever even came on the scene. And now it's potentially worse. Remember, the bottom line here is 54 to 46. That's the current Republican majority. But Republicans are defending 24 seats. Dems are only defending 10. And right there, that's a problem. You see, you have a lot more targets to hit, right? You already know the list. New Hampshire, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Illinois, North Carolina, places like that, where Democrats are really trying to put a dent in here. And I'm just going to go over a couple of the most interesting ones. Democrats have a real good chance here. New Hampshire's a place. Kelly Ayotte is the senator, the incumbent. She's running against the former New Hampshire governor, Maggie Hassan. Now, the Trump effect has been huge here. Kelly Ayotte is slightly behind in this race and has been one of these Republican incumbents who really can't even say the name of the Republican nominee who she's voting for and supports but hasn't endorsed and criticizes but is still voting for. You see the trouble? And she's getting hammered on this. So wow. You see this pattern in some other places around the country, too. Now, Trump is deeply unpopular in New Hampshire. Kelly Ayotte is a lot more popular than Trump is. And she's getting dragged down by this. Go down to Pennsylvania also, where Pat Toomey, the incumbent senator, is running against Katie McGinty. Now, she's up about 2.5. But here you see McGinty polling way behind Hillary Clinton, who's up an average of about 9 points across Pennsylvania. So Katie McGinty is one of the weaker Democratic candidates who, if this was a pure down ballot effect, she should be destroying Pat Toomey based on Hillary Clinton's coattails. She isn't. This isn't just a Trump effect. This is also a weak Hillary Clinton coattail effect, because Katie McGinty should be rocking that race, and she's really not. She is slightly ahead. Democrats really, really want that one, John. And outside money's pouring into Pennsylvania. It's a TV state. Gabby Giffords endorsed the Republican Pat Toomey because he sponsored a bill on universal background checks, so he got Gabby Giffords' endorsement. We'll see if that changes anything. And the last one I'll bring you to here is just Ohio, which is fascinating. Rob Portman is the incumbent running against a former congressman and Governor Ted Strickland. Portman is a Republican who's overcoming the Trump effect. Clinton is up about 5 in Ohio, John, but Rob Portman is up about 6. An 11-point swing. He's getting out from under the Trump effect, but he's one of the only ones. This is a problem across the board for Republicans, and they're fighting against this.
Finally, before we go, just a couple of seconds. So is the House, the problem in the House because of redistricting? When I say redistricting, my staff goes into a coma, but is part of it that they've engineered a permanent majority so the Tea Party is going to be back again no matter who wins the presidency?
Of course, gerrymandering and redistricting is an anti-democratic problem across the country. There's no question about it, but districts can swing. And the thing about Trump is he is not popular in any suburban areas, and people with college educations are not voting Trump. That's why Nancy Pelosi thinks she can make some gains here.
Good to remember. Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent, thanks so much.
You got it.
That's John Hockenberry at our partner, The Takeaway. For a number of years, Arizona educators have been working to figure out the best and swiftest ways to get young English language learners, or ELL students, up to speed. A 2-year pilot program was recently launched by the Arizona Department of Education in tandem with the State Board of Education, focusing on a tech-based language development program. Steve Gardner is the Senior Vice President of Sales and Marketing for Scientific Learning Corporation, the maker of Build English Fast, the program at the center of the pilot project. Steve, what are the basics of Build English Fast?
As it's named, it's really designed to help students more rapidly acquire academic English, which they need to be successful in our schools. It's unique in that it's computer-based. It was developed by 4 neuroscientists who applied the principles of neuroscience, understanding how the brain acquires languages, to develop a series of exercises that do really 3 fundamental things. One, they help prepare a student's brain to hear English. Most students of other languages literally don't have the speech sounds or the phonemes of the English language mapped in their brains. And so the exercises really help do that in a very rapid way. Secondly, they provide intensive practice in grammar, vocabulary, listening skills in English to help them, again, accelerate the pace at which they're learning English and the structure of the English language. And then finally, our program uses speech recognition technology, much like Siri on a phone. We use speech recognition technology to listen to students as they read literally hundreds of different passages and provide immediate feedback to help build reading fluency and comprehension that, again, prepare a great foundation for success in our schools.
Steve, I want to come back to a little bit about the research related to neuroscience and cognitive skills. There still is that consistent factor of each person's brain being a little bit different. Is this something that can be tailored to individuals?
Yeah, I think that's another benefit. Something that a computer can do very well is it can basically infinitely adapt based on each learner's pace, each learner's responses. And so our program literally provides thousands of trials and the path that each student may take and the pace at which they complete the exercises is going to be completely individualized to them.
At what point can we tell when a learner is not only on the right track, but ready for the next step?
There are several different elements of the program that really help teachers understand how the students are doing, where they are, what additional needs they may be that they need to reinforce or supplement in the classroom to help inform instruction. But literally, you know, again, as students are each completing their own path, all that information is organized and reported back to the teachers and the staff that are working with the students to see their learning trajectory, where they may be plateauing, and when they're ready to transition either out of the intervention itself or into another program within the intervention.
And Steve, how complicated does this get? And I'm in some cases, I'm actually talking about the program itself.
So we try to maintain kind of what we refer to as a zone of proximal development, where we know that learners that are getting a lot of things wrong and aren't progressing very quickly are going to become frustrated very easily, and that's going to impact their motivation and really their ability to learn. So we try and maintain about an 80% success rate and a 20% challenge rate. And so that level is maintained so that it's pretty natural in terms of where the students are, where they should be. And again, those that may need to accelerate more quickly, the program will understand that and will very quickly adapt and move them up into higher levels so that they're getting material that's appropriate for them and that's going to be appropriately challenging for them.
Is this the sort of thing that the company will work with a state or some other vendor or some other client and say, okay, this we can tailor this in particular to how you're looking at this? I mean, in Arizona, many English language learners, though not all, are coming from Spanish-speaking countries. Would this be adaptable to any other sort of community in this country or other countries?
Yeah, it's not designed specifically for one language. So this is not to help just people that are speakers of Spanish acquire English. It's really the underlying principles apply to anybody that's learning the English language. The benefits of the three-step process are going to, again, apply to any speakers of other languages.
Steve Gardner is the Senior Vice President of Sales and Marketing for Scientific Learning Corporation, the maker of Build English Fast, which Arizona is using as part of a pilot project. Robert Linquanti is a project director at WestEd. He specializes in English learner assessment evaluation and accountability policies and practices. Robert, how big an impact is technology having on ELL progress?
What we're seeing is certainly on the assessment side, more folks using voice recognition software in content assessment areas, tests that will have pop-up glossaries that are bilingual. And the idea is to not give kids unfair advantage, but it's to really remove some of the noise associated with their lower levels of English language proficiency so that they can really demonstrate what they are learning on content assessments in English. And the question is, how does technology, whenever it's used, particularly in the classroom, fit within the larger frame of the particular language development approach, the particular instructional program models, and the particular policies that a state, a district, and a school put into place? I think that's the key question. I think it's wise that the Arizona Department of Ed is doing a pilot, meaning instead of going full scale on something, to try out a smaller pilot and see what they can learn.
when technology is put into prime use, is there a concern potentially for almost a false sense of advancement, that we could potentially be advancing kids at a more accelerated pace than they've earned? Is that more or less likely with technology as opposed to the human eyes and ears?
Well, I think it depends on the particular purpose and use and context. So, for example, in a high-stakes testing situation, you do want to make sure that you are leveling the playing field. This is not creating unfair advantage, and of course anybody that uses these particular tools and supports needs to demonstrate that they are not providing unfair advantage. But I think what it's trying to do is make sure that we get clear signals from the particular assessments so that we are really understanding and we're not mixing it up with noise that's related to their evolving or their emerging English language proficiency. So in that context, I think it's absolutely right. And there are going to be temporary supports. If a student is not progressing in their English language proficiency, that really should provoke some serious questions with respect to what's the quality of teaching and learning going on in classrooms.
How big a priority does this need to be? And in that sense, then, how important does it need to have a pilot project like this or another related specifically to ELL?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question, Steve. When we look at this population, it is only growing, and it's not just in Arizona, it's nationally. We need to make sure we have autonomous learners, kids who know how to learn and work together in groups and get things done using language. And so it used to be, there was an old expression, you know, what works for all kids will work for English learners. I think the new standards and the new practices that employers are looking for, the capabilities that are looking for in their kids, really should be a signal to educators that what is going to be effective with English learners is actually going to be effective with all students.
Robert Linquanti is a project director at WestEd. We've been talking about English language learners and Arizona's new pilot project. When you think about the most memorable garments in a person's life, one that consistently comes to mind is a wedding dress. So designing them can be quite a challenge and a lot of pressure. Monique Sandoval is a wedding dress designer and the owner of the local shop Cleo and Clementine. She was also profiled as one of Phoenix New Times 100 creatives.
I never thought, oh, I want to design clothes. It's just been something that's part of my life. Like in high school, and I think that's the time where we're struggling to find our identities. And you are able to express yourself through clothes, I guess, stronger than you can voice your own opinions during that time. And in high school, I would alter my own clothes to fit. And I think fit is so important. It's just a minor stitch here and there to make something baggy, or if it's just ill-fitting shoulder seams, those types of details that you notice. And there was a difference from when I first put it on to after. It's just that feeling of something fitting better is what drew me into fashion. And being able to explore different textures and how they work, I guess it's just something that I've always been drawn to and came naturally.
I mean, in the big picture, how important do you think the wedding dress is to any woman who's getting married? I mean, is this something that, and does that bring extra pressure for you?
Absolutely.
But does it also have that extra inspiration as well?
It does, because you're chosen. You're part of their life now. You're not just a rack that they're going to pull from. You are there for them throughout. It's about a six-month period that we ask to have. You know, we meet over 5, 6, 7 times maybe. So you are now friends. They're in your mirror half-clothed, and you're talking and trying to make them feel comfortable at the same time while you're trying to hear what they need and make this gown for them. So absolutely. It's very, I mean, the pressure is there for sure.
You're talking about such an intimate and personal event, an intimate and personal garment that we're involved in. How do you, as a creative person, keep what it is that makes you unique as an artist with what your clients, your customers who come in and they want the magic that you bring, but it also has to be really personal to them? How do you balance those things? That seems amazing.
Well, you want to listen to your customer, because you may like a certain way of doing things, but they may have, let's say, well, you want to drop the V lower, but they're, no, let's come a little higher. Let's keep it conservative. You have to listen to them. But at the same time, you want to make sure that that does not affect the outcome. So you have to be honest and say, if I do it this way, X, Y, and Z will happen. So there is that harmony. When you meet somebody, you have to know, will this work out? Does this seem like we're on the same level here? And if so, great. And it happens naturally and we communicate, and it's about having healthy communication.
There are a lot of television shows, reality shows that have popped up that show a lot of women with their expectations for the wedding dress, and they have a group of people that come with them, and there are strong opinions expressed on all sides. Have you noticed, has that affected what you're seeing and what clients are asking of you, or are you seeing groups and groups of people with different opinions? Does that affect the work you're doing?
I think the type of people that we work with, it's not the same type of bridezilla, can I say, that you would see on TV. We have a consultation process to where we're, in a way, interviewing each other and find out, well, are we going to have a match? Do we communicate on parallel levels? Does she understand the way that we work, our aesthetic? Or is she coming in asking us to recreate another gown? Those types of situations, you just have to put your foot down and say no and decline, and know that someone else will come along that will give you that quality experience. You know, as a dressmaker, we want to be happy making the dress. We don't want to feel the pressure or the stress or the negative energy in our studio space. We try to omit that from the beginning by being honest on how we work and what we expect from the client.
Did you have any special experience yourself with your own wedding dress?
I made my own wedding dress. I did. And at that time, I had other orders. October is a busy month, and my husband and I were married on Halloween. And we we had issues. So where we had to, you were moving into a new house at the same time and had other wedding orders. So I put my dress together the night before. I had it designed, but I finally put it together the night before. But what is so special about how it came together is that my step-grandmother, who taught me how to sew, she was in town, so she was able to help. And then at the time, my niece, who I was showing the basics on how to put together a t-shirt, she was there too. So I had her cutting my tulle for me, and my grandma was fitting the bodice. So I love that it happened that way. Normally, we wouldn't want to wait till the last minute, but that's what happened for me. I still have my gown. It's special to me, and if my daughters want it, they can have it in the future. So yeah, it's special.
That's Monique Sandoval, wedding dress designer and owner of the shop Cleo and Clementine. She was profiled as one of the Phoenix New Times 100 creatives. You can see photos of some of her designs at kjzz.org. And we'll be talking with other Valley creatives in the coming weeks here on the show. The western burrowing owl is a federally protected bird found from Canada down to South America. Protected because the population is dwindling. Development affects their nesting habitat. As more human homes are built, burrowing owl homes are lost. But some owls are flocking to new digs in South Phoenix. The show's Annika Klein tells us who helped them get there.
The thing about the burrowing owl is they don't actually do the burrowing. Here's Kathy Wise with Audubon, Arizona.
They rely on other animals to make the burrows, and then they'll move into them. And one of the issues with the owls is that those burrowing mammals are disappearing.
Think of squirrels, foxes, or prairie dogs as the home builders, and the owls as the tenants. As Wise points out, those builders are disappearing, leaving the burrowing owl with fewer options. So Audubon, Arizona became a builder instead.
The burrows themselves are about 4 feet deep.
We're on a trail in the Rio Salado Habitat Restoration Area. We walk up to black tubes sticking a couple inches out of the dirt.
Flexible irrigation tubing, corrugated. And that is nice for the owls because they can just walk up it really easily, even the babies.
The tubes connect to 5-gallon buckets underground, which create the burrow. A burrowing owl is perched on a nearby branch, eyeing its visitors. But we don't seem to ruffle its feathers.
They'll chatter at you, more so in the springtime when they're breeding.
The Downtown Owls Project started in 2013, and since then, volunteers have built more than 250 burrows in this area, and they've relocated about 100 rescue owls to Rio Salado. Greg Clark is with Wild at Heart, an organization that rescues and cares for birds of prey.
We go out and we find the burrowing owls that are in trouble, usually out of housing development, and we trap those owls in a safe way so that no harm comes to the owl. And we bring them back to the care facility.
Then Clark looks for good properties to build artificial burrows. But it's a tough sell to a lot of landowners to give up part of their property for what's essentially an owl apartment complex.
So it might take me 2 or 3 years to find a farmer who really likes burrowing owls, wants to do something for wildlife, and happens to be in the right spot.
He says this site at Rio Salado is one of the most successful sites he's been involved with. And it's a little ironic when you consider the area's history.
Right now, where we're standing is a landfill. We stand on top.
Winston Lyons is a ranger with the Phoenix Parks and Recreation Department. And yes, the Rio Salado habitat used to be a literal dump.
Tires, copper, lead, refrigerators, dishwashers.
The 5-mile habitat along the river was restored in the 90s, and the owl homes have been one more step in that transformation. There are still industrial buildings across the riverbed, and planes fly overhead. But Lyon says maintaining wild habitats in an urban setting helps connect people to the natural world.
It's an environment for learning, educating the next set of rangers that will come and take my spot.
Wise says more than 1,000 community members helped with the project so far.
And in fact, about 40% of our volunteers didn't know that there even was such a thing as a burrowing owl or that they were in Arizona.
But now they're building the burrows and even collecting data about them. Wise says volunteers use an app to note observations about the burrows when they walk by them.
It's been very exciting for us to see that all the sites have been occupied. That's really the most important thing.
She says their next step is to put colored bands on the birds so people can track the activity of individual owls.
We're not sure if it's the same pair at a given site or if the birds are moving from site to site. There's a lot of unanswered questions.
Answering them will help the Downtown Owls Project find better ways to build burrows and make sure the birds call this place home for generations. For the show, I'm Annika Klein.
That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Steve Goldstein. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.